So this is Thursday, January 18th, 2007. Parasite community feces accumulation curve, enzyme kinetic metaphor, vice versa. This is actually a seminar that I started, that I gave back in the 70s when we were working on Leishmania and doing some comparative physiology studies. And at the time, really the focus was on the enzyme substrate complex, and it seemed to me that that was a little bit of a model or a metaphor for a lot of host parasite interactions. Enzyme specificity, for example, would means that the enzyme will act only on certain substrates, and there has to be a physical match between the structure of the substrate and that of the enzyme's active site and all this stuff, and that there was some set of events that took place once the parasite and host encountered one another. So if you sort of extended that whole area of thought, then you would see where those thoughts would lead. And also at the time, we were working on some purely theoretical material and doing some modeling. And so the idea of using some enzyme kinetics mathematics, or maybe I should just say analytical geometries about the level of that math, to describe some host parasite interactions. So that's what this is all about. The Mandelbrot diagram and all the different kinds of parasites in there are one that I really picked out of the 385 lecture. This seems to me to sort of model a host with its complexity and parasites living in different places. So I just thought it was a nice picture to start. Oh, come on. How do I do this? There we go. And exit. Will that go away in a minute or two?
No, maybe you have to get the one in the middle.
The one in the middle?
Yep.
There we go. So here's a typical species accumulation curve, and this is straight out of ecology, although I just made it by putting in some numbers. And the idea being that if you go to some environment and sample, then the more you sample, the more species you discover. And the upper limit of this curve then has some relationship to the particular habitat or nidus, if you will, in the case of parasites that you're studying. So for today's seminar, I just simply opened up my math book and asked what kind of simple equations generate these kinds of curves, and y equals the natural log of x. I'm sure you could derive this if you really wanted to, and I'm not going to. Gives you something that looks like this. And then I went in and just simply pulled open my analytical geometry book and came up with this one right here. So this particular equation, 1 over that, gives you that curve right there. So I figured that the reciprocal of that was a pretty good approximation then of the species accumulation curve. So that's exactly, I'm running out of batteries, that's exactly what that one is. And if you do this, then your first real term turns out to be 11 point something, so I just simply subtracted all that from 12, and this constant then would be the maximum number of species you could come up with, and then as your sampling effort continues, then your diminishing returns, your number of species that you discover gets fewer and fewer, and eventually gets. That's not very difficult to understand. However, you can also set this C in a variety of different, at any place you want to deal with relatively rich communities. And for a parasitological community that somebody's studying, 60 would be, of course, something up in the realm of ducks or black bears or what have you, rather than the stuff that we tend to study like small fish and rodents. I don't know that there's any any community, any place in the world, and maybe the tropics would be where small rodents would end up with 60 different kinds of parasites that you would expect to be able to find. Although the total global list, something like Microtus might, you know, is really pretty much up there. So these two curves really, then and this is really kind of the simple part. So you're looking at a rich community and a poor community, and again, the sampling effort measure, in this case, is nothing more than just numbers. And these are relative unitless numbers, so you couldn't necessarily say 3 days or 3 minutes or 12 days or 12 weeks or what have you, but those are just sort of relative and arbitrary numbers. So if you actually went out in the field and did this work, then you could and sample parasite communities until you found a maximum number, then the C would be your sort of richness constant. Now, for me, personally, I've never been able to figure out why parasitologists in particular are very concerned with this number right here. Seems to me that calculating the total richness of a parasite community is not a very intellectually challenging exercise. It would be the simple precursor to really all the good questions, which are, what are those species and what kind of transmission devices do they have, and which ones are congeneric and what have you. Nevertheless, we're still dealing with these kinds of curves right here. So these are actually typical saturation curves then. And they're ones that are characteristic of any process where your increased input initially results in some good results, but you have a point of diminishing returns that you get to before long. Now, for the ecologists, the basis of these kinds of curves are pretty obvious. So if you go to some habitat and start looking, and the number of species present is of some fundamental and realistic meaning to you, then you really kind of need to figure out how much to sample in order to get to that maximum number if you can, if that for some reason or another is really important to you. When I made this slide, of course, this is our Matthew. I think that's, is that Matt? Matt out at Cedar Point at Cedar Creek. I couldn't help thinking, just from watching this person operate over the last several years, that you might run out of species to find, but you're never going to run out of good ideas and new problems to study and stuff of that sort. It seems like every time he goes to the field, he comes out with five or six more ideas of good things to do. So I think that your problem supply, or your research potential research project supply, is maybe the inverse of this diminishing returns thing. So the real issue parasitologically is, in my view, is what determines the value of this. And here we get to the landscape epidemiology, or the natural nidality issue, or the problem. So what determines your richness constant, and what is the nature of this landscape epizootiology that then results in the sustenance or the sustaining power of this environment, this landscape? What is it about this landscape that allows it to sustain that number right there? And so that, I think, is really the real biological issue involved. So let me sort of take a little bit of a side detour, and then talk about this enzyme kinetics metaphor. And I've gone back to this so that instead of really talking about it as host specificity or the results of host parasite interactions, I now have tried to go back and use the equations from really comparative physiology to try to get at this issue one more time of whether or not parasites interact in some way, because this is really the heart of this of this Trends in Parasitology paper, namely whether parasites in a community are isolated from one another interactively or whether they do interact. This is the old Holmes-Price interactivity continuum where groups of parasites occupying host populations are considered on one extreme to be totally independent of one another, and on the other extreme are considered to be members of a real community that have ecological interactions with one another. So, for example, do all the tapeworms in a grebe or a duck really have any association with one another physiologically or not? Do they influence one another's lives? And some, at one extreme the answer is yeah, on the other extreme the answer is no. So the methods for determining this there are a good many in the literature, and none of them are particularly satisfactory. So that's really why I tried to do this. So I went back really to a model that we had published on back in the 90s, and that's the so-called multiple kind lottery, and it's set up. And I can show you the code if you're interested after we get finished talking about this. It's rather elementary. It's almost straight out of some middle school's kids' first programming efforts, but it seems to work. So what the multiple kind lottery is really a version of the binomial expansion of the P plus Q equation. And what it does, it sets up an array of parasites. So this is really your sort of supra community. And there are as many different kinds as you want to, and I just call them A, B, C, D up until you run out of letters. And the idea being that you set up a block of membership, a block of places in this array where all of the A's can go. And the point being that this block, which would be right here, you have an option for going to this block and not getting infected. And you can go anywhere in this whole array. So in this case, because we started out with 12 parasites, I just gave each of these different kinds of parasites 100 slots in the array, and started with some prevalences that seemed like they were typical of what you'd find if you went to the field. And so the prevalence of A here would be 40%, the prevalence of B would be 20%, and so forth. So then you let your host go into this sort of big array of parasites, sample at random anywhere up and down here, and you can do it once, or you can do it 10 times, or you can do it 1,000 times, or you can do it 5,000 times. And then you ask, what does this host come up with? So that's really the basis of the model. So you have this big parasite supply distributed in the landscape, and what's of issue here, or what's of importance here, is that you have these different parasites have their relative probabilities of success, and your host can sample as often you want to. And furthermore, you can have different numbers of hosts in your sample. So you can say, okay, I'm going to have one host sample this 100 times or 1,000 times or 5,000 times, or I'm going to have 20 or 30 hosts sample it in any number of times. So throughout most all the rest of the data, I really picked 24 hosts because that's kind of the maximum number of small fish that you could process in a 2 or 3 day period and count everything. And because I kind of grew up in this ecology business studying small fish, that's what I work with. But the squirrel's prettier than the small fish, so gave the squirrel. So here's what it looks like, and here are all the here are all, and I use actually 12. There's another one that goes here. It's L0, which means non-infectious. So that's what the sort of the grid looks like, or the parasitological community out there in the landscape actually looks like. And you can throw that dart in as many as you want to. So and you don't know where you're throwing. You just throw it. So, what I started with, and I made these up, so those numbers, there's nothing magic about those, but they seemed like ones that you see all the time in published work, and they're the kind of stuff that we see all the time in some of our research. So I just picked that out. And the term mean prevalence, these are the percentages, these are not the percentage, these are actually the decimal fraction of each of those blocks that are real parasites as opposed to failures to get a parasite. And the prevalences then would be those things converted into percentage. So the mean prevalence here is about almost 34%. Mean prevalence has never really been used except in a couple of three cases of papers that we published as any kind of a meaningful measure of the properties of the landscape. But in after the parasites actually sample that big supply that's out there, then with some other measures, mean prevalence does take on some significance because of the correlations that you get between that figure and some other measures of diversity if you sample over and over and over again. So this is what it looks like, so here's the sampling curve, and these are really arbitrary, again, sampling units, and just for the heck of it, I set all the prevalences at 0.5 and asked what would happen there, and as you might imagine, you get a little bit steeper curve. This one's the one we're going to work with a little bit. And this is a sample of 24 hosts, each making an effort of 10, 50, what have you. And it looks like in this case, then each host has to sample about 500 times before your average number of parasites in this that you discover by studying those hosts gets up to the maximum number that you could have. Now, the other thing is you can always then ask the flip question, which is how many hosts do I need to look at? And again, I did this just by setting effort at an arbitrary 1,000. Because, you know, who knows what constitutes an effort of 1,000 on the part of some little animal out there in nature. If you live 1,000 minutes, if you live 1,000 hours, you know, if you cover, 1,000 square meters, who knows what that means. But in general, I think if a small fish, for example, lives 2 years on the average, then every single day you're in contact, and actually every instant you have the potential for picking up a parasite, at least if they're there in the environment. Some of them are there most of the time. So these numbers are really not too bad. So this graph really tells you about, you know, what we all know, and that is if you have a community like this, you really need to look at about 20 to 25 hosts to get a good indication of what all is there. There are also a couple of things that not everybody remembers, and one of these is that species richness is simply nothing more than the number of species present. But there are also a couple of other measures of community structure, and one of these is the diversity index, and this is really the Shannon Weaver diversity index calculation. It's known as H prime. It's an entropy equation, and the other one is the diversity of the whole sample. So you can sample each of these hosts and ask about the diversity of the parasite community and calculate for them, and then take an average, and that's one kind of a measure. And then you can add everything up and do the same calculation, and that's the measure of your sample. And those two measures, along with the average number of species of parasites per host, are really three we'll talk about here. So here again is our same curve with those other two values plotted, the average Shannon Weaver diversity and the sample diversity. And there's a couple of things that we might want to talk about just a little bit, because I'm not sure that anybody's really reported this before, but maybe it's in the literature. The mean diversity value for Shannon Weaver actually levels out. The diversity of the communities within individual hosts tends to level out, and this levels out really far beyond or far below the predicted maximum diversity index value for a community of 12 taxa, because of the probability of failure. So that as soon, unless your prevalence is 100% with every parasite, this value here, the individual host can never get the full richness of the community. The other thing that happens is the more and more these hosts sample this big supply of parasites, diversity in the population goes up for a while, but then it slowly drops off. And the reason for this is that these hosts as a group start to accumulate larger numbers of the more prevalent parasites, and that then, because of the way that diversity index is calculated, reduces the number. So it seems to me those two curves are really worthy of some further exploration, and in particular within the context of the structural features of the landscape. Now we get back to mean prevalence, and I ran a couple of these and just made up some more. Here's our initial one, and made up another batch of prevalences in which the mean prevalence was about half of what it was, the other one was. And this just tells you then, and when your mean prevalence is low, no matter how much you sample, even if you go a 500-fold effort, increase your efforts of sampling 500 times, you still can't get everything that's there. And so this really gets back to what the probability of infection does to your picture that results, your picture of the parasite community that results from the sampling effort. And so the difference between these two figures right here is really kind of the difference between the sum probability of getting infected with parasites in those two different landscapes.
How about if you go in and crush everything that exists on the site? Don't leave anything. What will that tell you? All the specimens in the population, all the individuals.
We can do that very easily if we have enough time.
Yeah.
I think the software will allow it.
I just wondered what it would be.
We'll try it.
Okay.
And if we run out of time, then that means I have to type a couple others. But we'll try it. It might work. Because you only have, 1,200 parasites, right? But you have, the problem is you have the opportunity for failure. And any time you have the opportunity to not be infected, then I think you're stuck. Yeah. Then the critical question then really becomes, what landscape features influence the probability of infection? Okay, so I can't remember where I did it. Oh, I just took some. I just made up some of these things in a more realistic, sort of student grade set of communities, and these are the same five species, and I just made up some prevalences here and calculated some mean prevalences, and let's see what that set of graph looks like. And it looks like you might expect, you know, again, if you have, you know, there's about a five-fold difference here in average prevalence, and that means you have to exert about a 50-fold difference in sampling to get to the stuff. But what it really says is that in a poor community, you end up finding most of the species in a hurry, unless they're really, really rare. And most of us work with poor communities. And this is nothing. This is all, before I get into the enzyme stuff, this is also a little bit of sort of an interesting look that your species accumulation curve, your species density curve levels off, but your number of parasites of different species keeps growing and growing no matter how much you sample them. So that this stuff really seems to me to be what controls the slope of those lines is, again, the interesting parasitology question rather than what's the level of this stuff. Okay, where are we? Well, these are fairly familiar, and this is these pictures really off of Wikipedia. They're nothing more, and this one's straight out of a freshman textbook, of course, that talks about substrate concentration and active sites, and these red things are your enzyme particles. And if you actually do a little enzyme action, I don't know whether they still do. They do this in 101 lab?
No.
We did it in biochemistry lab.
You did this stuff in biochem? Yeah, you do it in all kinds of different classes. Get some enzyme and vary the concentration of substrate and then calculate the rate of the reaction. And you, years and years ago, we all did this graphically so that you took the maximum rate and took half that value and that half your Vmax, and the concentration that gave you that was called Michaelis-Menten I forgot how to pronounce it.
Right.
Yeah, was that right?
Michaelis-Menten
constant, or the Km. So calculating your Km then was really a kind of an afternoon's work in biochem lab. However, there's also what's called the Lineweaver-Burt plot, which you can derive from these data, and you can do it really with this equation right here, which is not a very sophisticated one, regardless of what it looks like. So all you really have to do in order to draw this line is calculate the Km. And then calculate the slope of that line, which is the Km over Vmax, and it's not very difficult. Now, however, the enzyme literature is really kind of interesting and intriguing on one introductory biochem level point, and go back to that, and that is the behavior of this line with different reaction mixtures. Will give you an indication of what's going on in that mixture. And I'll come back to this in a second. So here are the data that we've talked about. That's the Lineweaver-Burt plot of this pi community. And I just calculated it and drew it. And again, it's your it's this parasite community we've been looking at, and it's this sampling of hosts that we've been looking at. And so that's with our original prevalence. And no competition between parasites. So now, my thought was, can we use this little set of analytical geometry to detect competition between parasites? Okay. And the answer is, what should you look for if you're going to do it? So if you're going to, if you're studying the effects of, say, competitive inhibitors on enzyme actions, these are molecules that mimic in some way the substrate but don't allow the reaction to proceed, and you do these things at various concentrations, then what you get is these Lineweaver-Burt plots that rotate around the intercept. Right there, and yet if you have non-competitive inhibitors, then you get Lineweaver-Burt plots that rotate around that point. And so you ought to be able to distinguish between competitive and non-competitive interactions. And so I went back to the model and did a little bit of inhibition exercise. And in order to make it kind of show up, what I really did was make parasite K eliminate C altogether. So every time the host got a C or got a K, then it would wipe out whatever parasites of species C that it had gotten. So it would do this over and over and over and over again. So the only way a parasite could actually get a C would be that it didn't get K, and both of these prevalences are really, really pretty high. And it would be extreme competition that you would never find in nature, and that's what it looks like. And so what it really looks like here is that our Lineweaver Burke lines are not showing up as competitive inhibition, but as non-competitive inhibition. So I decided to make it even more extreme, and that is have K not only eliminate C, but eliminate a couple of the another one. So every time a host picked up a parasite K, then it immediately got rid of whatever parasites of C or G that it had. And again, these things don't rotate around this intercept. They tend to be rotating around here. So, first of all, this is a kind of an unexpected result. And secondly, it tells you really that messing with this model, if you have a month and are inclined to do it, to come up with sort of numbers that allow you to spread those lines out a little bit, and then to go back and put into the model other kinds of interactions. And the easiest one would be to, and this is really in the publication, the easiest one to write into the model is one where you have an ecological association. Now we get to the landscape epidemiology part of it, where you have an ecological association between a couple of different species of parasites, so that if you get one, then you're automatically going to get one or the other, and so they reinforce one another. And that would be, and that's the thing that I really didn't have time to get to today, or I would have done it for you, but that's really sort of the next step. So we might then go back to really the metaphor and ask, what are these velocities and what is substrate? Because I've been sort of liberal in equating velocity with number of species and substrate concentration with amount of effort. So this is actually a rate number. Velocity is a number of molecules modified per time, usually. But in the case of those parasite species accumulation curves, there are also velocities, because the number of species that you discovered with per unit of effort. And your substrate here is really the amount of effort involved, in which is really your exposure to the big supply of parasites out in the landscape. So I think that these things are really pretty legitimate. They're not quite as flaky as metaphors, but they're somewhere between totally or totally applicable easily and metaphor, somewhere about halfway in between them. So V is actually the number of species found. S is actually the sampling effort. So the analytical geometry is really pretty intriguing, but somebody needs to sit down and expand on this metaphor a little bit and explore it theoretically using some of the software, and sort of see if we can come up with a means for actually detecting interactivity. So at any rate, the old parasitologist's conclusion then is that the real issue is relative prevalence, and ultimately relative prevalence deals with the probability of infection, and it drives the species accumulation curve dynamics. And actually then what really matters is the host, and in those cases where you're talking about species accumulation curves, I think unless, and this gets us back really to the practicality of doing this work, I think unless you can go into a landscape and sample those hosts non-destructively, and the logistics of sampling doesn't prohibit you from getting a good sample, then there's no way you can actually use these ideas in nature or in a real piece of research. So the small fish systems seem to work pretty well. I don't know how you would actually I've never been certain that the small rodent sampling stuff was non-destructive, but it seems to me also if your size of your area is big enough, then the small rodent sampling is really not particularly destructive. But in terms of human parasites, in terms of large domestic animals and stuff, I think the mathematics will prevent you from really satisfactorily applying any of the math involved in the species accumulation curve stuff. And I think that's about all I have. If you want to, yeah, Terry.
Could you go back to those birthing plots of the parasites?
The Lineweaver birth. These right here.
So I have. I think that would be the coolest thing if you're actually modeling competitive inhibition and you get a non-competitive line like this. Which, it's always fun to throw something in the face of something else. But I actually think that those are modeled to be non-competitive. K is a non-competitive inhibitor of C and G in both cases. If they're given two different blocks, and K, if the presence of K actually eliminates C, that would actually be a non-competitive.
Ooh, that's a major point. That's a major point I didn't think of. So the comment here, the question with these three Lineweaver Burk plots that look non-competitive, K eliminates C in the tally, but K and C and G, but K doesn't necessarily hit the same block. Okay, no, that's a major point, Terry. Absolutely major point, and the software is not very difficult to fix in that regard. No, that's an excellent point. Ooh, that's a super point. So Anita is a sucker. A good student to come along and spend a couple of months with the software and just do this stuff. You never know. You might have nice little paper.
That actually could be tested in schistosomes and echinostomes. Because, you remember when the echinostome hits the schistosome, hits the snail, then the radia eat the schistosome radia, or the schistosome sporocysts. And so basically this may actually be testable with the snail schistosome echinostome system.
Yep, that's a possibility. But Terry, no, that's a spectacular comment, and you're right on target. Anybody else? So you want to see the software or not?
Yeah.
Yeah. Code.
How would you quantify that? Would you just count so carry the production and using that as, or would you have to go in, smash the snail, and actually count the
radius? You'd have to go in, do the sampling, and then go in through it and do massive numbers of smashes.
I'm not 100% sure that I have that on this computer, but let's look.
Yeah, that would be huge. I smashed probably 35,000 snails, and we found all these different kinds of interactions going on, but we didn't. It was all field collected data.
Ooh. Well, I have a version of it, okay? This may not be the latest version, but let's look. Justin, you want to flip off one of the slides? So this is really all it is, and you can see that it's fairly crude because I took it out of some GW Basic stuff and just got impatient and numbered the lines just because it ends up being too much trouble to keep track of them otherwise. But that's all it looks like, actually, and what do we have up here? This stuff sets some values. This stuff really sets the values of your various prevalences in the blocks. That loop, 1 to 1200, makes all the parasites and the failure blocks. That little open for output is a check on whether or not the program's working correctly. This stuff, this loop, the IJ stuff, selects all the parasites and adds them up. And this section adds up all the number of species. And this calculates the diversity indices. And there's your data. This is, I don't know. I don't know that I actually have the real version. Let's see if we can run this. Now I'm going to have to. This is actually an early version. So what I'm going to have to do is write a couple of. I would have to write a couple of sentences to get us to sample everything.
Okay.
And that's a little bit.
It would be interesting to see what it looks like.
I'll do it and send you an email. No, but I'll do it and send you an email.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
So if we can imagine that a host is like a host has. It's like a molecule of an enzyme. It's sitting there and it has an open site.
Yeah.
I think that's what Carrie was saying. That open site then is occupied by a parasite. And so you can imagine that this thing would, you could model it almost specifically if these parasites only go into these certain sites, like some tapeworms only go into the anterior part of the small intestine, unless Manila formis is there. And if Manila formis is there first, then the tapeworms do come in, but they're posterior,
mm-hmm.
right? So, and then, so that's kind of like saying that these sites exist on these enzymes,
yep.
the substrate that sticks on.
Yep.
I think that you could model it in that way.
Yep. Yep.
But that's not exactly what they're looking for either. You've already, the complexity of the model skyrockets if you actually look at site specificity in the host. They just want to know what's there and how long does it take to get there and how can we turn that into a model. They don't actually want to know how these things interact. They just want to know if they can find interactions based on numbers.
So the goal here then would be to come up with a simple computer model that would test for interaction.
And that model is written. It's on my flash drive.
Exactly.
It's actually on my machine at home.
Okay.
And it is so incredibly simple and incredibly easy, and I'm absolutely convinced that anybody who would be willing to spend 60 days could take Terry's idea and convert it into a nice paper.
Mm-hmm. I think that would be a good idea. I mean, if the intestine is one humongous enzyme, and if an active site is already filled, then it's not like this particular parasite isn't going to infect at all. It's just going to find a similar active site further down the road and infect down there. So, yeah, that's still success if it gets grabbed eventually. So,
right, but the success would be the measured egg output, because otherwise it's irrelevant.
Well, the Lineweaver-Burk stuff that Terry referred to, that's real easy to fix. I mean, just super easy. And I think the Lineweaver-Burk application is really that brings the whole modeling thing to closure a little bit. But then it's not much of a leap to turn that into a gut.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really not. Because the array is linear already.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the next step is to go and look at what the work of the schistosome guys have done with the competition. on the snail schistosome echinostome competition data. I know there's a pile of it out there.
Anybody else?
That was pretty exciting.